Hi. Thanks for having me here. I should say, I think I finished putting my slides together about an hour ago, so some of these might be a surprise to me as well. But hopefully I don't say, oh, I should also say, my background is on astrophysics, high energy astrophysics, astronomy, gravitational wave searches. So if I say anything wrong about the actual particles, about the axions or the bosons that we're looking at, it is my fault. It is not the fault of my colleagues. It is entirely my own fault. So I think everyone has heard about the gravitational wave detections by LIGO, and so far they've all been from two merging objects, right? Two compact objects, neutron stars or black holes, spiraling in, circling in, and because you have this changing mass quadrupole moments as it's going around changing in time, you get gravitational wave emission from this. And these are just some of kind of a sampling of some of the results that have shown up in the last couple of years. And that there's, you know, this plot over here. I think probably everyone's seen this, but this is from the very first detection where we definitely detected, where we found the signal from the last phase of two large black holes merging into each other. Last year, Virgo also joined in the search and finally got a detection in all three of these detectors. And then last year in August, there was the detection of two neutron stars merging into each other. And that was especially exciting for some people because with neutron stars, you have matter. With matter, you have electromagnetic emission. And then you had observations of a gamma ray burst at high energies and also of a kilonova at lower energies. Anyway, a lot of people were very excited, and a lot of people are still very excited about mergers of compact objects. Oh, yeah, I should also say, I forgot I put these in. Yeah, these are a surprise. So I was recently, earlier this week, I was at a different meeting for gravitational waves, and just to give you a little summary of some of the new results that have come out. So they have been from modifying some of the pipelines and making sure they really understand the detectors and things like that. There are now four new announced binary black hole merger events in the data, bringing us to a total of 10 binary black holes, one binary neutron star. Some of these are kind of exciting, I think, because there's one up here that's super heavy, where the first mass is somewhere between 40, 80 solar masses. The second one's up here. So this event up here is that's pretty exciting. I think in comparison, the previous heaviest one, 1509-14, is right here in this blue one, and now we have this big purple lump up here. So that's interesting. Yeah, also fun is that, yeah, here's a figure that shows the known black holes, stellar mass black holes. So we have a bunch down here between 5 and 20 solar masses, so between 5 and 20 times the mass of the sun. And these are the purple ones, these are all electromagnetically detected. And then you have the LIGO gravitationally detected ones that go up to maybe 80 solar masses. And so then you have to, you know, so then there's some interesting games you can play about, are these the same population of black holes? Are they different populations of black holes? Do black holes within the galaxy and outside of the galaxy look different? So we've been talking about, sure, gravitational waves from two neutron stars, or two, sorry, two compact objects merging into each other, but you could also get gravitational waves from, for instance, mountains on neutron stars, because all you need is something that's a little asymmetric, that's moving around. And so if you have, for instance, if you have a mountain on this neutron star, as it's moving around, it will still emit gravitational waves. And so these sources are different from the standard mergers because they are orders of magnitude weaker, but they last for a lot longer. And so instead of studying and searching for transient events, so really short blips in time of a couple of seconds or less than a minute long, what we're doing is we're searching for very long-lived weak signals. So this talk in general, I'm starting off, we already discussed a little bit about how we've detected gravitational waves from merging compact objects. So I'm going to be discussing instead how we search for continuous gravitational waves. So these are these long-lived signals. So continuous gravitational waves from isolated neutron stars. All right, and then we get tired of neutron stars because we haven't found anything. So we are instead going to focus on boson clouds around black holes, bosons, axions. And then, yeah, and overall, we're taking an astronomy approach with this whole search. So this is going to be the series, I guess, the series of events in my talk. So we start off, when we talk about neutron stars, we're talking about neutron stars with asymmetries. So you have a star, it's pretty massive, starts out, and at some point, as time marches on, it goes supernova. The star is no longer stable, it explodes, it goes supernova. depending on the conditions and the mass and things like that of the star, what's left behind is a neutron star. So just a, basically a mass zeroth order. It's a mass of neutrons, very dense. And because the supernova is a violent catastrophic event, you wouldn't expect the neutron star at the center to be perfectly spherical when it's born. You expect it to be bumpy and kind of asymmetric and have all these little lumps and wiggles on it. You would also expect that all of these bumps would kind of smooth out over time. And so the idea, though, is if you catch these neutron stars early enough, if they're young enough, they should still have pretty large mountains on them. And these mountains, as the neutron star rotates around, will emit gravitational waves that you should be able to detect. So there are a couple of different mechanisms, but the one I'm going to be focusing on is the mountain or the bump on the neutron star. And the idea, I guess the main takeaway is that, what do I want to say with this? Yeah, the gravitational wave frequency is going to be twice the rotational frequency. You're going to get, so this here is the expression for the strain. So this is just how strong the signal is. And the signal is stronger if you have, obviously if it's closer, but also if it's, the signal strength will also depend on how fast it's rotating and then how bumpy it is. So this ellipticity, this epsilon, is basically a measure of how bumpy it is. So when we actually search for these signals, it's slightly more complicated than that, because the signal in time is this sort of varying sinusoid, and that's all great. And so if it's just a varying sinusoid, you just Fourier transform it, and in the frequency domain, you should get a single peak. So that's pretty straightforward if we know what we're looking for. The waveform at the detector, the signal at the detector is a little bit different, because what happens is the Earth rotates around itself, and it revolves around the sun. And so that means if you're searching for these signals over, let's say, 4 months of data, then when the Earth is over here, the signal is going to be experiencing one Doppler shift. And when the Earth is over here, it's going to be experiencing a different Doppler shift, which means that overall, you can't just look for one single frequency. You have to take into account that Doppler, that frequency evolution throughout your stretch of data. And so what you have to do is you have to be able to, you know, take what you see, say it came from this part of the sky, therefore this is the Doppler shift, and then you take out that Doppler modulation, and then you would theoretically get this sort of peak again. So the best case scenario is that we have a pulsar, a known pulsar. This means we have a neutron star and we know how fast it's spinning and we know exactly how its spin is, how its frequency is evolving in time, how it's changing in time. So you know the frequency, you know the frequency derivatives, you know where it is in the sky, so you know exactly how the frequency is going to be Doppler modulated throughout your data span. And so that's sort of the best case scenario, because then you only have to search one set of parameters for each individual object. And when you do that, I mean, spoiler, we haven't detected anything so far. So what you do is you say, okay, we haven't detected anything, which means that this particular neutron star, for instance, if it is emitting gravitational waves, the gravitational waves have to be weaker than this point over here, so anything around here. When you know that, when you have a constraint on how strong the emission is, then you can work backwards and say, well, what's the constraint then on how lumpy it is or how tall the mountain is? And so you start with and you say, so any gravitational wave emission from this pulsar has to be quieter than this amount, and then you work backwards and say, well, the pulsar is that far away, and so I know that mountains can't be any higher than, you know, centimeters or millimeters on this one particular neutron star. If you don't have pulsations, you can still do pretty well, because there are a lot of times, you know, you have a supernova, and at the end of the supernova, you have maybe a supernova remnant as the material is blown out. In the center of these supernova remnants, you could have a neutron star. And so in that case, you know where it is in the sky, but you don't know its frequency or frequency derivatives. So you only have to figure out the Doppler modulation pattern for one point of the sky, so that helps. But you still have to search, for instance, frequency, frequency derivative, and maybe multiple orders in frequency derivative. So you can do a little bit better like that. And in this case, your interpretation is going to be a little bit different, because you don't know how fast the neutron star is spinning. So you can still set upper limits. So for instance, here what we're looking at is vertical axis, again, is the upper limit on strain, and on the horizontal axis is our search frequency. So you can still say, this particular object, if it's spinning, so if it's emitting gravitational waves at 600 hertz, so it's spinning at 300 times per second, if it's spinning that fast and it is emitting gravitational waves, they have to be...
I knew it. I broke it.
that case, what we do is we say, all right, if it's spinning at 300 times per second, anything it's emitting must be quieter than this. So if it's true that it's spinning at 300 times per second, then the total size of the mountains must be less than this height. So you kind of have to take two steps. You have to say, assuming it's spinning at this frequency or at this frequency, what can we then say about the size of the mountains? So you, yeah, so that's a little bit less constraining, but at least you have some information there, something physically interesting. Then we get to the final scenario where we have no idea what's going on. So there should be over 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 neutron stars in this galaxy. If you just make some assumptions about, we know approximately how many stars there are, and because only stars above a certain mass can turn into neutron stars, then you kind of can guess how many neutron stars there should be. So far, we've discovered 2,500 pulsars, which means there's at least this many neutron stars that are hidden from us, right? And not all neutron stars are going to be pulsars. Even if some neutron stars are inherently pulsars, if they're emitting this pulse radiation, maybe we're just not in the line of sight. So you would not expect to detect pulse emission for every single neutron star, even if they do, even if they are all emitting this pulse emission. So in this case, why not search all over the sky? So in this case, you have to, demodulate for every single part of the sky, and you have to search for the frequency and frequency derivatives in every point in the sky. So you can see these searches quickly become expensive. And then there's a trade-off. Because the search is more expensive, you're not going to be as sensitive in these all-sky searches. But the plus side, you can actually say things about the entire population in the sky instead of any individual source. So when you do that, you have to take one more step and you say, so here what I'm showing is the upper limits, or the search results, I guess, from a recent low frequency all sky search. Again, this is strain, or how strong the gravitational wave signal would be. This is the search frequency. And so now what you're saying is any gravitational wave emission from neutron stars anywhere in the sky emitting at these particular frequencies must be quieter than this amount, which means when you want to say something astrophysically interesting about it, you have to make some assumptions about how far away those neutron stars are. And so then you would say, if we're looking at a neutron star that's 10 kiloparsecs away, so maybe at the center of the galaxy, if we're looking at the neutron star at the center of the galaxy that's spinning 30 times per second, then any mountains on that neutron star must be less than, what is it? Neutron star is 10 kilometers and the four, must be less than 1 meter high for any neutron star in the center of the galaxy. Otherwise, we would have detected emission from it already.
For neutron star, let's say, at 1 kiloparsec, if we take the most pessimistic limit on the strain, whatever, will light see it or will future detectors see it?
That depends on, the answer to that question depends on whether I'm trying to apply for money or not. If I'm writing proposals, the answer is yes, any moment now we should be able to detect something from a neutron star. There are many neutron stars and many of them should be close to us. Many of them should be young, so why wouldn't we detect something? Realistically, it's hard to say whether the detection is going to be next science run or next generation or even later than that. Because the problem is, it's really hard to know. All of this depends on sort of the neutron star equation of state and what's the largest mountain size that could be sustained on this neutron star, and that is very unclear, and I'm not sure if we're at the limits yet from this where it's physically interesting, where we're actually setting constraints on the equations of state.
Is there a lower limit on the ellipticity?
There is a lower limit. I don't remember what it is, but it's, I think, 10 to the negative 12 or negative 18. I know those are very different numbers. But basically, it's still much lower than anything we can get at right now.
Where does the beacon come from?
No idea, but I don't remember. I do know I do know a minimum exists. I don't remember where it comes from, but the literature will know.
There is an assumption then built in on the. Oh, but that's because you're saying it's
Internal.
So we took the So based on our AllSky search, that was saying, what can we say about neutron stars and anywhere in the galaxy? So we decided, well, why can't you just change your signal model a little bit and say, if we were to do a search for instance, boson or axion annihilations anywhere in the sky, what we could do then is take our search results from there, figure out some sort of, can we say something interesting then about constraining the model here? Ultimately, what does the total signal from all the black holes in our galaxy look like? Because one thing that's different from a standard CW search, and I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by this actually, I'm realizing it's slightly out of order. In a standard CW search, we care about neutron stars. Every neutron star is spinning at its own frequency. That means the signal from every neutron star is going to be at a slightly different frequency. Instead, if you care about axion annihilations, the frequency, the axion exists at this one frequency or at this one mass, then the total signal from any of these black holes is going to be roughly the same. And so what you end up having is a slightly different model, basically a slightly different signal waveform you have to care about in your searches. So this is where I'm going to start to talk about continuous waves from boson clouds or axion clouds. I'm going to play a little bit fast and loose with notation and terminology. Again, if I get any words wrong, it's my fault. It is not the fault of the people we're working with. Let's see. So this is my understanding, and you all can tell me better than I can if this is true. So this is my understanding of what happens. And so note, we are focusing on scalar particles right now. So my understanding is you get a black hole, it's formed with some mass and some spin, and the spin is large enough that you could get a cloud of these bosons or axions forming around the black hole via the super radiance instability. This cloud will deplete, will take some of the energy and angular momentum from the black hole. At some point, the cloud builds up pretty quickly, and at some point you get axion annihilations within the cloud, and so you have you basically have emission of a gravitational wave at a very well-defined frequency because it just comes from these two particles annihilating, and you end up getting you would expect to get sort of a continuous gravitational wave signature from this. Continuous as in it's very long-lasting, very long-lived, and in this case, it has very little change in frequency, very little frequency evolution compared to what we normally look at. So some key relations that we're talking about here is for us, so let's see, we have the system with a black hole with a certain mass and a certain spin. You have a certain mass of the boson, and then that determines roughly the frequency of the gravitational wave emission, and you have a black hole at a distance d from the Earth. So the frequency that we're looking for is basically going to be determined by the mass of the boson. The strain is going to be very strongly dependent on the mass of both the boson and also the black hole. And the time scale of the emission is going to, again, depend very strongly on the boson and black hole masses. I think those numbers are right, and if they're not, I apologize. It's all entirely my fault and not the fault of the papers that came up with them in the first place. So before I get into what our search is doing or what we're looking at, I just want to go over a couple of searches that are already a little bit more advanced or a little bit more mature. So this was a presentation just a couple days ago at GAPOA. So this group, they are looking for, they're doing directed searches. So what they're looking at is, we know with the LIGO detections, the LIGO mergers, the LIGO events, you have a very heavy black hole at the end of it. You know basically what its mass is, you know what its distance is, and you have some idea of what its spin is. So based on that, you can do a pretty good sensitive search for this type of emission from axion annihilations around that black hole in particular. And when they looked at this, what I'm showing here is a figure of, let's see, this is spin, this is black hole mass. These curves are for different axion masses. These are the scalar particles. And then here, what they're saying is, The resultant black hole from GW150914, the very first LIGO detection, I don't remember what, yeah, so the resultant black hole was at this mass, 60, 70 solar masses. It would have had to have been 11 megaparsecs away for their algorithm to have detected it. I think that's over an order of magnitude closer than it actually was. So what this is saying is that with this generation of detectors, with this type of search, we might not be able to do anything. with these events because these are just entirely too far away. But with the next generation of detectors, then you really get to, then you're within a very interesting range there. Basically, the next generation, you could detect something with this.
But this is just based on a single event.
This is based on a single event. So I don't, I think this is their methods paper. I'm not sure if this is actually search results. So this is just based on the single event, yes.
So is it actually easier to see the stochastic background generated by four bubbles?
Exactly. It's good, yep. You must be psychic, because the next slide is about what happens if instead you search for the stochastic gravitational wave backgrounds. So this was another presentation at this last meeting. So what this group is doing is saying, instead of looking for one individual source, which we do in CW searches, they're saying, let's look for the stochastic background from all the sources in the observable universe, let's say. This is something that I can't quite speak to because this is a little bit outside my wheelhouse. But what they're doing here is they're plotting basically, what they're saying is these are sort of the sensitivity curves for LIGO. This was the first observing run, so when I first started, and this is the design sensitivity, so what we're trying to get to, or what LIGO's trying to get to. And anything above these curves would be detectable. So what they did was, in this figure, they're taking a couple of different assumptions about the boson mass, and then they took some assumptions about the population of black holes, either the population of isolated black holes. They're saying that they're assuming this goes from the lightest ones are 3 solar masses, the heavier ones are 50 solar masses, and also looking at the remnant, the merger remnant black holes, which are going to be just twice as heavy, I guess. And so they're looking and trying to see, would any of these populations be observable in initial light, or sorry, in the first observing run, and also at the very end of this generation of LIGO. And I think what they're saying is, it should be detectable, assuming the signal would be detectable, assuming that these, assuming their assumptions hold. Because keep in mind, right, the strength and time scale of the signal goes as a very high power of black hole mass. And so if you have something that's 50 solar masses or 100 solar masses, that's very different. It's going to give you a very different result from something that's 20 solar masses, for instance.
Do you know what the difference between the dotted lines and the...
Yeah. The dotted is for when they assume isolated black holes. I think the only difference there is that they're just a different mass range. They might... Oh, different rates as well. They have different rates for isolated black holes and merger remnant black holes. Yeah, and then dotted is merger remnants. Yeah, so the things that go into there are masses and rates. Let's see. There's another group within LIGO, or I guess a group within LIGO, that is searching for, that's taking also a continuous wave search kind of point of view. I'm afraid I don't know very much about this search, but the idea is that they're looking, again, across the entire sky, and they're looking for these signals. And they do have some figures on how far they would expect to be able to detect this emission. So depending on the boson mass, you know, and I'm not sure exactly what these curves are about, but you know, you might be able to detect emission up until megaparsecs, even gigaparsecs. That's not quite gigaparsecs. Megaparsecs are hundreds of megaparsecs away, which is interesting, but I don't know the details of this paper. But I'm just saying that this paper also exists. So there are other ways, there are multiple ways people are approaching this problem of looking for this emission from these boson annihilations. So our approach is we're going to take more of an astronomy approach. We're going to focus on the black holes within our galaxy and what we kind of know about the black holes within our galaxy. We are using a simulation of where the isolated black holes are in our galaxy, and combine that with information about how fast they're spinning, how fast they're moving, and how heavy they are. We're calculating the expected signal from all of these black holes, so the ensemble signal, and then we're going to search for this. So the people we're working with, so Daichi and Orita, they are black hole, I mean, among other things, they are the ones who first performed this simulation of isolated black holes. They actually, so the original study they were doing this for, they cared about black holes in the galaxy that are moving through the interstellar medium. As they're moving through the interstellar medium, they're hitting material, they're accreting the material, and they could be emitting X-rays. So they cared because they wanted to know, could we in the future detect isolated black holes solely because they're moving through the interstellar medium? And so, let's see, yes. And then Richard Brito, he is the guy that I emailed saying, can you please put all these constants back in? Because I don't know where G equals H bar equals C equals 1. I don't know what to do with that. I don't know what frequency that is. So Richard is the one who has sort of worked through all of the equations and everything for us. If you have any questions about details about the signal model, I would ask Richard.
So how much do you gain if you know exactly the location of the black hole as opposed to there being one black hole somewhere in your sphere? What's the ESNR, the effective ESNR gain or lose by saying, well, trying to say, where should I go?
Mm-hmm.
I go deep on a single black hole that I know where it is, or a collection of black holes that I don't know where they are, but collectively I'm going to be trying to add this single field.
Yeah, that a lot of that will depend on things like, you know, where your black hole is, right? Because it, like we saw with the merger remnant black holes, they're tens of megaparsecs away, right? I don't remember. Yeah, they're too far away to be interesting. But if we know that there's a black hole that's only kiloparsecs away, then we could really, right? Because then we could say, given these assumptions about what the boson is, then we would know whether or not. We would know what the strength of the signal we expect to detect from that black hole. The downside of our approach, where we take into account all the black holes in the galaxy, is that our approach is very heavily dependent on assumptions about the black hole population. So whereas in the case of, for instance, Max's search, where he knows exactly how heavy that black hole is, he can say a lot more about if that black hole is close enough that it's interesting, he can say a lot more about the underlying distribution or the underlying black hole boson properties. So again, from a CW data analysis point of view, what we have is two bosons turning into one graviton, which means that the inherent frequency depends almost entirely on the boson mass. There's going to be some other secondary or second order effects, but right now I'm just caring about the zeroth order, I'm just caring about the boson mass. The black holes are also moving towards or away from us, which means that the observed frequency will be Doppler shifted due to the motion of the black hole. So the actual observed frequency could be slightly greater than or less than the source, the frequency of the source. And the fact that you have all black holes or all black holes with the right properties and the right time scales, et cetera, all black holes will have these clouds that will emit this continuous wave. And so therefore, we should be looking for the ensemble signal that's produced by all these black holes. How am I doing on time, by the way? Is there a clock somewhere? There's a clock right there. Cool. All right. So this is just showing what the parameter space we're interested in. So in our search, this is actually a typo. Originally we were going from 20 to 500 hertz, but we're actually going to go from 80 to 500 hertz. That gives you a boson mass between a few times 10 to the negative 14 and 10 to the negative 12 electron volts, or EV, I don't know what's electron volts. And depending on, so this is just showing, this is a figure. These are the same thing. This is just a linear scale. This is a semi-log scale. So this is just showing how the gravitational wave frequency depends almost entirely on the boson mass and only a little bit on things like the black hole mass and the different colors. No. The different colors are the different spins and the different line types are the different black hole masses. So, all right, so what do I mean by an astronomy approach? I talked a little bit about it, what kind of parameters we need to care about. So what are those parameters? So you need to know besides what you can say about the black hole properties, the population of black holes. You will need to know where they are, because if they're closer or farther away, the signal is going to be stronger or weaker. You need to know how massive they are, because the mass figures into basically everything about the signal. So you need to know how fast they're growing, because that's going to shift your underlying frequency. You need to know how fast they're spinning, because that, first of all, determines if it's going to form in the first place, and also tells you if the cloud forms, and also tells you to propagate about the strength of the signal. And requirements of the signal. So based on the black hole properties, basically, that determines the properties of the annihilation signal that we're searching for. So how close do we actually need black holes to be? So we haven't run the search yet, but we estimate that we're going to be sensitive to signals with a strain of greater than 10 to the 25. What that means is we took this figure, so this figure we saw before for an all-sky search. We're running a new all-sky search, it's slightly modified, so even though we're going to much higher frequencies, we can still get pretty good sensitivities down here. So we estimate we can run the search from 80 to 500 hertz, and we're going to detect anything that is stronger than for the strain that's higher than 10 to the negative 25. So that's what we're assuming in all of this. All right, so how close do we actually need black holes to be in this case? So we have the galaxy.
galaxy, we have the disk of the galaxy. The Earth is about 8 kiloparsecs away from the center of the galaxy. The radius of the galaxy, depending on who you ask, is 15 or 20 kiloparsecs, which means so we're about 8 kiloparsecs from the center of the galaxy, and then we're about 23 kiloparsecs from the opposite edge of the galaxy, roughly speaking. What I'm saying here is, assume we have a boson of mass 2 times 10 to the negative 13 eV, and this gives you a gravitational wave frequency of around 100 hertz. This on the y-axis is distance, on the x-axis is black hole mass. And what these are curves of strain, of equal strain. So what this tells you is that if you have, for this, a boson at this mass, if you have a black hole that's 25 solar masses, you can, and it is at the galactic center, what am I doing? No. If it's at, and it's only a couple of kiloparsecs away, then the strain will be somewhere around 10 to the negative 26, which is below the level I was talking about. So what's going to be interesting to us is everything in this region down here, everything below negative 25. And the problem is, I have this thing over here that says MBH disfigured. This goes back to the question of how heavy are the heaviest black holes in our galaxy. And so you can do this for different boson masses. When you get to 4 times 10 to the negative 13 electron volts, you end up getting, so again, everything below this purple curve is interesting to us. So what's interesting to us is below this purple curve and also kind of to the left of this shaded region. And so everything in here, up to about 5 kiloparsecs, is theoretically interesting to us. It would be detectable for us. And as you go up to higher and higher frequencies, those curves kind of shift up and up, and so you should be able to detect these signals from farther and farther away.
Sorry, can you say again why the shaded region? So how do you need to favor
that? Yeah, I'll talk about that a little bit later, but yeah, I will talk about that a little bit later, actually. Short answer. Yeah, so theoretically, this is great, right? With heavier black holes, we can detect the signal to much farther away. And that's all fine and well, except that you have to talk about the signal timescales. Because with heavier black holes, the signals last for much shorter amounts of time. And I'm not sure if I'm not sure if this is an artifact or an actual thing. What I'm showing here is the timescale of the gravitational wave, the expected signal, in years on the y-axis, the boson mass on the x-axis, and these are curves for different black hole masses. What this says is that if you have a boson emitting at this, frequency, or this mass, then anything sort of, so these are 30 solar masses, 15, 10 solar mass black holes. If your boson is down here, then any signal from reasonable black holes in the galaxy is still going to be going on, because the age of the Milky Way is right around here, this dotted line here. But once you get to higher and higher boson masses, even though the signal strength is getting bigger, the signal duration is really dropping rapidly by orders of magnitude. And so this starts to become a problem. So, all right, so first thing we care about, going back to what we need, is we need to care about the positions of the bosons. This is just going over really quickly how we simulated where the black holes are. So what they did was, this group, what we did is they took the gravitational potential of the galaxy. So the galaxy is a disk with a bulge and then a dark matter halo. You take the gravitational potential of the galaxy, you take the initial spatial distribution, so 85% of stars are born in the disk, 15% of the stars are born in the bulge, and then you combine that, and you also give it an initial velocity distribution. So in the galaxy, everything is kind of swirling around the center of the galaxy. So there's that bulk velocity distribution. But also with supernovas, you get kind of natal kicks, because supernovas are very explosive events, and that can kick out something very fast. And so when they combined all this information and worked forwards in time, then they ended up with the distribution of where 10 to the 8 black holes are in the galaxy and how fast they're moving, and also in which directions. This is sort of a summary of kind of the results where you see, this is just plotting a subset of the black holes, where you see a component in the disk and then a smaller component in the bulge around the galactic center. Yeah, I think that's all I want to say for this slide. And now we get to the question of the black hole mass, because this really matters for signal strength, duration, and frequency. So the black hole mass really matters. And so we can start with what is known about black holes in the galaxy. So the known black holes in the galaxy are all known because they are in binary systems, like Cygnus X1 here, where you have a companion star it's sending material off, and the material is being accreted by the black hole. And because that material is being accreted very rapidly by the black hole, it's emitting things like X-rays, and then you might get secondary emission like radio and optical, or the RF. If you look at the X-ray observations, for instance, you look at the X-ray observations, you can start to pick out little periodicities. And from that, you can start to say things like, you can, and also if you look at, sometimes if you look at how they're moving around each other, then you can start to see constrain the mass of the black hole. So in this case, for instance, Cygnus X1, the black hole is thought to be about 15 solar masses. If you take a look, so what I'm showing here is a study where they took all the known black holes in the galaxy with some sort of distribution on their masses, and they put them all together and said, can we describe this entire set of 15 or 20, 15 black holes maybe, as one single distribution? And if they did that, then they said that galactic black holes in these binary systems should be around 8 solar masses with a standard deviation of around 1. There's also, you can also use what's called the Salpeter initial mass function. This is from observations of stars in the galaxy. This just says that if you're looking for stars that are heavier than a certain stellar mass, then that distribution, then that falls off with a power law, like a power law with this particular with a particular power law index. But the question here is, what's the heavy, you know, what's Nmax? What's the heaviest stellar mass or black hole mass you can get? That is uncertain. If you look at what we already know about black holes, so you, like we've discussed, the light-intensive black holes get up to 80 or 100 solar masses. This is from the Nolan plot. But the problem is, these black holes are all from outside our galaxy. If you look at the black holes within our galaxy, the heaviest one is around 20 solar masses, and they're big error bars. So this could be just an issue of maybe these evolve differently, or you know, maybe there is some sort of selection effect for why this is happening. But it could also be that there's something inherently different about our galaxy compared to the galaxies that are hosting these heavy LIGO-detected black holes. Now what's going on there is that how heavy can your heaviest stars or heaviest black holes be? That depends a lot on the percentage of heavy elements in your galaxy, so the metallicity. And in terms of astronomy, heavy elements means anything heavier than helium. What happens is if you have anything that's heavier than helium, these are the metals in astronomy, when you have heavier elements, you can't develop very, you're basically, if you have heavier elements, you have a very large star, very massive star, with more heavy elements, with large, with higher metallicity, the star starts to lose mass a lot faster. Because what's happening is, when you have heavier elements, the star is producing radiation at the core, because it's undergoing fusion. It's producing radiation. With heavier elements, that radiation is getting absorbed. More and more of that radiation gets absorbed by the heavy elements on the outside of the star. That means the outside of the star starts to fly away much more rapidly than if you had fewer heavy elements, right? So these are the stellar winds. These are the radiation-driven stellar winds. And so what this means is, here in black is metallicity that is like that of the solar system, approximately that of the entire Milky Way. That means that no matter how heavy your star is initially, going up to 140, 150 solar masses, no matter what, the final black hole mass you can form is not going to be higher than 20 solar masses. Now this is just one study, right? And this has its own set of assumptions and things like that. But overall, the trend is that if you go to higher metallicities, you cannot form very heavy black holes. You can get around this by saying there could be parts of our galaxy that have lower metallicities, but then you have to start fine-tuning your parameters and stuff, and so it's not entirely clear if we would expect black holes heavier than 20 solar masses in the galaxy, depending on which theorist you ask, of course. And this means that in our assumptions and all our studies, we're basically saying 20 solar masses is reasonably the heaviest we can go, maybe 25 or 30. So for our studies, what we're doing is we're assuming a couple of different mass distributions. So one of them is the Gaussian distribution from the observed black holes in X-ray binaries. The problem is then, if you only observe them under certain conditions, then maybe there's some selection effects, selection biases. The other thing we're going to do is use a power law distribution up to some minimum mass of the black hole. Yeah, and just roughly 20 solar masses, you know, very reasonable. And then when you get to 30 solar masses, astronomers get upset. So we try to stop at around 20 solar masses. Yes, velocity. The velocity of the black hole is important because then that will give you a little Doppler shift, your signal frequency.
Sorry, yeah. Cutoff for this scale, the stability is not at 30, right? It's like around 50 or so. So why did you set the cutoff to be 30? So the cutoff here is not the parent stability cutoff?
No, sorry, it's not the parent stability cutoff. It's what we're doing, we're just going for what has been observed kind of in our galaxy. So this is not so much, not completely on theoretical background. It's part theoretical, part observational constraints.
But then we'll be talking about our galaxy being very special because LIGOs found many black holes that are on top.
Not necessarily, because there are a lot of galaxies out there, and it might be that, it's probably that our galaxy is very boring, but that, like, the black holes detected by LIGO are going to be preferentially the larger black holes.
Sure.
The heavier black holes, and so there's, you know, tens of millions and billions of galaxies within this parameter space volume, and a small fraction of them have these large black holes, and the ones that have large black holes happen to have low metallicities. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but that seems like the theory is also a bit ad hoc. You know, okay, we see these binaries that have these distribution masses, but okay, we see binaries that are. We see black holes are in binaries,
mm-hmm.
and the black hole that is much larger than 20-ish or 30 might just eat up the star, and then when you're a binary, the increase. So we're interested in a very significant bias there, which is in, just we're using observations of binary neutron galaxies to guide the example. Which also it's kind of funny to ignore everything else that we're seeing tonight.
But so. It's not entirely guided by the distribution of. So I am saying we are using this distribution of known black holes, but that has a limit because there's only 15 of them or whatever. So that's why we are going up to these heavier masses. And you're saying why don't we go up to even heavier masses
yeah.
with black holes? That's just what we decided to do because it's partly observational guidance. It's also partly theoretical guidance. The fact that within our galaxy at least, it's very uncertain if you would on theoretical grounds get black holes that are heavier. This. Because any black holes that are heavier than this, the progenitor star would have already lost too much mass. But I should say we haven't written the paper yet. I'm very happy to change that maximum mass to heavier ones.
So that I feel this urge to kind of keep back when someone says, well, astronomers get upset, and then so be it.
Oh, no, that's totally fine. I mean, I'm just kind of, you know, clearing my hair around here. I mean, a little bit flippant here. It's not that astronomers get upset necessarily, it's just that it is kind of difficult theory-wise to introduce heavier black holes in our own galaxy in particular. It's just that, right, so brief interlude, why does our galaxy have higher metallicity? I mean, there's some galaxies that just, you increase the overall abundance of heavy elements in a galaxy if it's gone through multiple stages of things like supernovae and things like that. Each time a star goes supernova, you get heavier elements, the star explodes, those heavier elements get pushed out throughout the galaxy, and so the next generation of stars that forms with more heavy elements. And so depending on when the galaxy forms and conditions within the galaxy and things like that, how heavy it is initially and stuff, you're going to get a different just metallicity, and therefore you get a different kind of population of stars in that galaxy.
Yeah. Maybe related to that, I guess you're more interested in sort of recently formed black holes, sort of cosmologically speaking, as opposed to like the entire history because you needed to be more relatively recently to produce these signals.
Yeah, that's sort of a side effect. So what we're saying is we're just interested in black holes in our galaxy. And, I see what you're saying, because maybe the initial black holes that were born in the galaxy, yeah, we're not taking that into account. Maybe the black holes that were born first in our galaxy that were really old, maybe they could have been a little bit more massive. That's true. Yeah, we're not taking that into account. That's true. Okay, so we talk about the velocity now. So there's a bulk motion within the galaxy, that's all fine. But then there's the question of how large are the black hole kicks during the supernova? What we know, we can start with what's known about pulsars, so neutron stars. Pulsars generally can be born with very large kicks. They can be as high as a few hundred kilometers a second. We don't know black hole kicks. We don't know how large those are. But what we can say is that, well, black holes are heavier than neutron stars, so all things being equal, you would expect black holes to have smaller kicks. But this is also another thing we could say that I think is interesting is that black holes don't have surfaces compared to, I mean, neutron stars have surfaces, black holes don't. If you have some sort of asymmetric deposition of power, that's going to have something to rebound off of when you have a neutron star, that neutron star is going to get kicked out. When you have an asymmetric deposition of power to a black hole, it's going to fall in. It's going to affect, obviously, it's going to affect the black hole trajectory a little bit, but not as much if you're just purely bouncing off of it. And so with all of this combined, basically our assumption is going to be very small needle kicks. And this matters because small versus large needle kicks. You have very large needle kicks, then you could have black holes being much farther away. You can have them all the way out past the galactic halo. If you have small needle kicks, they're still going to be in the disk of the galaxy, and on average, they're going to be closer to us. And then when it comes to spin, we don't know. So we're taking a uniform spin distribution between 0 and 1. It's not known what the distribution is. There's some indications that the LIGO distributed black holes, for instance, have spins that are on average closer to 0. But again, slightly different population, maybe, right? Different masses, they're born outside the galaxy, small. Yeah. Black holes and binaries versus isolated black holes. So it's entirely unclear right now, I think, what you would expect the distribution of spins to be. We're just taking from 0 to 1. So, yeah, just summarizing our overall assumptions. Okay, so here's some examples. Here are some examples of what we expect the signal to look like. So these are a bunch of plots that are kind of heavy, we're kind of busy. What's happening is on the upper left-hand plot, so for all of these, we're assuming a boson mass. And therefore gravitational wave frequency, roughly. On the upper left-hand plot, what we have is the strain versus the black hole mass. And the dotted line is what is detectable to us. So anything above this line is detectable to us, which means that if we have bosons at around this mass, then we would be able to detect black hole signatures, or signatures from black holes 20 solar masses and up. What you have here is strain versus the observed frequency. And so what you're seeing is that due to partly the inherent spread in the signal frequency as well as the motion of the black holes around us, that you would get a spread within a few hertz. And this might not be that interesting, but it's, you know, inherent from an outside point of view, it's really interesting to us in CW searches. But what happens in a CW search? And this is our type of search in particular, different search might be a little different. What happens in a CW search is you have detector data that's pretty noisy. The detectors are they're a little bit finicky. So you have detector data that's kind of noisy. And so when you're looking for signals above that noisy detector data, you don't want to necessarily, you want to minimize the effect of that detector disturbance, right? You want to minimize the effect of the noise floor moving around. And so a lot of times what we'll do is we'll average out the noise floor. And that's fine, we'll average out the effects of the noise floor so that signals can stand out because they're sort of isolating, you know, they're sort of small frequency ranges. But if you have a large frequency range, then you have, and all these strong signals could be building up on top of each other, they could be affecting larger stretches of data. And so when we're running our searches, we could be accidentally averaging out the signal from all the underlying signal from all these black holes. So that's one thing we started to notice when we were doing these things. For a boson at this mass, you would need black holes that are around 20 solar masses and up. You would also need them to be relatively close to us, a couple of hundred parsecs, which is not too bad though, because roughly speaking, there's a black hole every 10 parsecs or so on average. If there's a black hole every 10 parsecs or so, we get enough black holes within a couple of hundred parsecs of us that we should be able to detect something. We would be able to detect something assuming that this existed, assuming all of my assumptions hold. We can play the same game where we go up to 200 hertz or a black hole or a boson a little bit heavier. And then, right, as you can see, we don't need black holes any heavier than 15 solar masses. So this is cut off. So this distribution I'm using cuts off 15 solar masses. We can go even higher. If we go even higher or even larger black hole masses, that just means we're going to have louder and louder signals. And so same thing happens if you use sort of the Gaussian distribution that's centered around 7. This is sort of the pessimistic distribution about black hole masses. You would still expect to get detectable signals with this distribution of black holes. So you don't really need very heavy black holes to be able to detect something. This is also all folding in things like signal timescales. And the signal timescales get important because at 300 Yeah, 300 hertz. Again, you don't need black holes to be very heavy. You need just very reasonable black hole assumptions about the black hole mass, and you don't need them to be that close to us, but only 1% of the signals are still detectable, right? That's because the time scale of the signal goes as 1 over black hole mass to the 14th or something like that. And so as soon as you get slightly heavier black holes, that signal time scale really starts to drop and you lose a lot of signal, they fall out. And so if you have no cutoff time scale, we would have, the signal would look like this, 2 orders of magnitude above, thousands and thousands of signals. And we don't see that, so yeah, anyway, cutoff time scales are important. That's what I'm trying to say there. Let's see, yep. Yeah, and then at this point it becomes a game of going, you know, higher boson mass, and then what happens if you get a larger spread in signal, in the observed frequency of the signals, you get very reasonable black hole masses producing the signals that you care about. So this is sort of the way we're approaching things, is we're kind of trying to simulate what this entire signal distribution looks like. And why is it important? So I told you one reason why it's important that we care about sort of the density of signals and the fact they're spread out. We might also be able to use the properties of this entire ensemble of signals to be able to pick out the expected signals better. So everything's moving around the galaxy. Everything in the Milky Way moving around a disk. And we are, so yeah, moving around a disk at around a couple hundred kilometers per second. That means if we're over here and things are moving around us like this, then things over there, we're going this way, things over there are going to be slightly, blue shifted or red shifted? It's going to be slightly shifted. It has a very particular, right? So different parts, red shifted, I can't even tell. Doesn't matter. Yeah. So different parts of the galaxy, right? Everything on one side of the galaxy is going to be redshifted. Everything on the other side of the galaxy is going to be blue shifted. If we have that information and we know sort of the underlying what the expectation of signals would be, the expected frequency of the signals would be without that shift, then we put in that shift, we might be able to work backwards and say, not only is this an ensemble of signals that are kind of loud, but they also have the redshift distribution you would expect from things within the galaxy. And this is important because, like I said, the detectors are plagued with a lot of noise. And a lot of noise can really, so, and with us, because we're looking for slightly different, non-traditional signals, we're relaxing our requirements on how to get rid of noise a little bit. And so for us, it's really important to be able to find more and more ways to be able to distinguish between things that are produced on the Earth and things that actually have a galactic origin. So I think that's it. Yeah, so our search is running and we're gonna start processing our results next spring. If you wanna be part of this actually, I should have put a slide. So I'm part of a group that works on searches from Einstein at Home. This is, if you've heard of SETI at Home, this is a distributed computing network. Basically people volunteer sign up and their computers are not running, which is very rare for physicists. But if your computer's not running and it's just hanging out, you can use your computer's spare compute cycles to do searches for things like continuous gravitational waves or for pulsars. I can tell you the searches for pulsars have actually found things. So we also do searches for pulsars and gamma rays. So if you want to join the effort, you can do that. And I think they're different, you can join the team, different teams. Frederick Sue probably has a team. Not sure. And so our search should be finished next spring, March or so. It's going to take a little while to analyze those results because we're doing things a little bit differently from a standard search. And we're also finalizing assumptions about the black hole population, things like masses and stuff like that. If you want to talk, if you want to convince me that we should go to heavier black holes or different spin distributions, that's totally fine. We just have to change a couple of numbers of code. It's really clunky code. I just wrote an IPython notebook, so it's very easy to change. And I think that's it.
Yeah,
that's it.
So let's say you detect nothing, right? So in principle, we can use that to place constraint on the axion mass, for example,
mm-hmm.
Right? But are you going to place this constraint based on individual black holes, or do you have a combined statistic for all these populations and get a better constraint?
We would like to do the latter, right? Because I think it'd be better to be able to have some sort of combined, some kind of coherent statistic that takes into account the entire population. This is part of what's going to take us a little bit longer, I think, is because we have to develop that statistic first, try to figure this out first. If we don't detect anything, I mean, we're going to say something about either the existence of this particular type of signal slash foci, or the expected population of black holes in the galaxy. Someone pointed out, William pointed out earlier, maybe black holes just don't spin very high. Maybe their spins are not very high, and so that just really drops down how many signals you would get. I think what's even more interesting, maybe, is what happens if we, what can we say if we only detect one signal? Because from what we've been seeing, you know, if you detect one black hole, you're going to detect hundreds, thousands of black holes. So I think what might be more interesting is what happens if you only detect one black hole or a couple of black holes, because I think from there you will actually be able to say something constraining about, because in that case we can say the boson exists, and then we can use
raise the world respond then. You could use one, what's the
sure. I mean, depending on what set of assumptions you're starting from, then yeah, you could play some game as to what that says.
So I guess this the same question applies for the standard TW search for this one here, especially massive stellar. So if you have a monochromatic white source, you accumulate SNR with square root of the time of your analysis.
Yeah.
So your analysis, does it iterate over the whole, all two, or all three, whatever, or do you chunk it in? So I just wanted to know how far are you from the formal most optimistic scenario.
So our search, and different searches are going to be different. Our search is on O1, so that's 4 months of total data. We're dividing that into, I forget how many segments. What happens is if you take that whole 4 months of data at once and you search for one single waveform, one single signal coherently over that entire 4 months, your computational cost really starts to add up because you have to do it over the entire 4 months. What we do instead is what's called a semi-coherent search, where we split it up into, let's say, a couple of weeks at a time. What we do is then we search for the signal coherently within those couple of weeks, and then again in this next couple of weeks. So we kind of parallelize it, which makes it a lot faster, but that also means we lose some information. We lose the coherence, right? So we lose some sensitivity there. Our search is going to be, so we're doing a search over the 4 months. I don't remember what the coherence length is. I think we're doing like 12 seconds, no, 20 seconds maybe, or something like that. Did I answer your question? Was that your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I did not have to do the calculation in my head, not on a pencil and paper, but in my head.
Yeah.
Of how far are you from the idea of root of D?
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I think.
Something we're going to go like square root of T, and something would be like the fourth root of T, and then it's just the addition of all that.
Yeah, and I think I'm not very clear on exactly how things will go with this semi coherent searches. I guess I should say, practically speaking, I mean, you see that there's multiple groups approaching this in multiple ways. Realistically, we haven't seen anything in our, if the signal exists, it's at a rate, if it's something that we can detect right now, we would have already seen it, basically. The one caveat, though, is that all of it I've done is with some assumptions and stuff. And there's also the caveat I was saying before of maybe we've already accidentally averaged out our signal. So there are some parts of parameter space that are sort of still interesting to explore, but it's not entirely clear to me that we can say anything with the LIGO frequency range, for instance, so this particular range of masses, with
so
these assumptions.
So now, if something were there, you would have seen it, but not if you are not doing the most efficient coherent search. So you can pay the price, so it could be that something is just borderline. Now, have you been able to do the most efficient analysis, you would have seen.
Yeah, I guess my thing is that in most of these, and again, these have their own assumptions, in most of the things we were doing with reasonable assumptions about black hole mass and maybe pessimistic ones, if the signal existed, it would be two orders of magnitude above detectable, for instance. We would have had all these signals that would have been above detectable, because we've already done sort of all-sky searches at a certain, and they've given us some sort of upper limits on gravitational wave strain and things like that. So that's sort of what I mean. If it exists, we would have detected it already because it's so easy. It could very quickly get very, very strong signals.
Yeah.
But all of this comes with a lot of assumptions.
That's right. People are going to play with the speeds and
feel free to, yes, absolutely. Because again, this might be slightly, this might be this is probably way over optimistic about the distribution of black hole spins because we're just doing flat uniform. And so, yeah, and so I think probably after mass, I think spin is probably a huge part of this as well, of all the assumptions that goes into here.
But so say you do this search, you get the results, you find nothing, and you assume that this population statistics are correct, then what range of those unmasses are you relevant? Like,
-10^-13 to -12. Yeah, or a few times 10^-14 up to 10^-12. Okay. Yeah, that's our range. One thing is, I want to ask you all a question. I don't know very much about these axioms in particular, but I know that, for instance, there's groups in gamma rays who are searching for, what is it, you have the axion photon oscillations in a strong magnetic field. And so you could get that around, if you look at the, not necessarily a strong magnetic field, but if the axion is traveling for a long distance and the magnetic field is there for the entire distance, then over that long bridge you get these oscillations. And so I know there are groups in gamma rays who are looking for excesses in observed spectra, for instance, and trying to attribute that to axion photon oscillations. I know if you go in one direction for axial mass, you can get the interesting magnetic fields are galactic scale. If you go in the other direction for axial mass, the interesting the magnetic fields are around a magnetron. Is there a sense for are these axions at these masses also going to? Would you also expect these oscillations for these axions? And what kind of mass what kind of magnetic field scale would that be? Something between magnetar and galactic. Is there anything that even exists that could
Yes, like all the axions, like if they have photon couplings, they will do that.
Yeah.
But like the ones that you are searching for has very like weak self interactions,
okay,
and interactions with matter.
Okay.
So these analysis, they will be looking at like this FA parameter of like 10^10 GeV ish.
Okay. Yeah.
And you are looking at 10^18, so it's completely different problems.
Yeah, different scale. Okay. So it's just that the magnetic fields don't exist? It's not just that, it's also that the interaction just would be much weaker.
Yeah, so like for you, like the interaction is much weaker, so they will need maybe like a magnetar magnetic field over like a megaparsec to look for.
Okay, so if you have a megaparsec full of magnetars lined up in a row,
yeah,
then that can be.
Any other questions? That's thanks. I'll go again.